Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition, host Craig LeBeau will be talking with David Rowland, a lawyer for Show Me Cannabis, about their lawsuit against numerous Missouri drug task forces for sunshine law violations. Then, in the second half of the show, Allie Catherine Bush was scheduled to talk with Kim Case of the Missouri Sheriff's Association Crime Victims Unit, but due to illness, we will have to bring her on at a later date. Instead, we are going to replay an interview Allie did in April of last year with Kirsten Tynan of the Fully Informed Jury Association. We also want to thank our engineer today, Jessica Thomas, for sitting in for Beth Pike. Stay tuned for our calendar of events and Kay Ray's commentary from behind the bars in the middle of the show, and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Coming up is Craig and his guest.
This is Craig LeBeau, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice. My guest today is David Rowland, and he's going to be talking about Show Me Cannabis. He is the attorney representing them in some cases relating to the Sunshine Law in the state of Missouri. David is the director of litigation and co-founder of the Freedom Center of Missouri and serves as their secretary for the Freedom Center's board of directors. He has undergraduate degrees in political science and biblical studies, and a law degree, along with a master's in theology. Following law school, Dave spent more than 3 years in the nation's capital as an attorney with the Institute for Justice. His work has been discussed in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and other major newspapers, and he currently resides in Mexico City, Missouri, with his family. Welcome, David.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Okay. As I mentioned, you're the attorney for Show Me Cannabis. So before we get into the background of what the Sunshine Law is and the lawsuit, can you tell us a little bit what Show Me Cannabis is?
Yes. Show Me Cannabis is an organization here in Missouri that believes that the drug war is basically a failed policy. We've given it roughly 40 years, and all it's done is produce horrific results without actually doing much to make society safer or more productive in any way. And so Show Me Cannabis is working to try and educate people about the failures of the drug war and to promote alternative policies that will better suit the nation moving forward. Specifically, they are working on proposals to decriminalize marijuana in Missouri and to make clear that that there are much higher priorities that the government should have than trying to prevent people from using what is effectively a drug that is less harmful than products that are currently legal, such as tobacco and alcohol.
All right. Now, you said it's had horrendous results, the drug war. What are the bad results that have happened?
Well, mass incarceration is the worst result. We have adopted policies that have resulted in huge numbers of Americans being sent to sit in jail, and we've used trillions of dollars of public money over the years towards this end, and what it does is it removes people from being a productive part of society, forces them to live separate from their loved ones on the public dime, and it wrecks families and communities, and we've seen that all over the country. And so essentially, When there are all of these negative effects without any of the positive effects that the drug war was supposed to bring about, it's time to end this terrible experiment and make clear that people should be free to use at least marijuana, which is a product that over the years has been shown to be less dangerous than, say, tobacco or alcohol.
Okay, and let's move in some aspects of the Sunshine lawsuit. First of all, can you tell us what the Intergovernmental Drug Laws Enforcement Act is?
Yes. So you asked about the intergovernmental drug laws, and so it's effectively what Missouri did is, in order to fight the drug war, they created a law that allowed for these police groups that transcend regular jurisdictional boundaries. Ordinarily, police function subject to the oversight and the governance of one jurisdiction. And if they go outside of that jurisdiction, they lose their authority. But what they decided to do with the multi-jurisdictional drug task forces is to extend the boundaries of the jurisdiction of many officers. And in doing so, they actually removed a lot of the traditional checks on police power. And so what we've done is through this law, we have given an enormous expansion of authority without expanding the public's oversight over how that authority is being used. And the law also gives the Department of Public Safety the responsibility to oversee these groups to some extent, to make sure that they are being properly governed. The law requires each of these multi-jurisdictional task forces to be subject to the oversight of a board that's composed of the chief law enforcement officers of the participating jurisdictions. And so the idea of that is, even though the officers will not necessarily be accountable to any one jurisdiction, the boards would work together to ensure that there is still some measure of accountability over these officers who have been given this otherwise extraordinary amount of power. But the law only works if there's actually a board that is functioning and meeting and playing this oversight role. And the problem that Show Me Cannabis found is that in at least two major circumstances, the city of St. Louis and Kansas City, they technically had these boards, but the boards never met. The boards never functioned in any way to oversee the task forces that that were receiving all of this money and authority from the state. And that's what prompted the lawsuits eventually, was not only this failure to adequately oversee the functioning of the task forces, but also the task force's refusal to abide by Missouri Sunshine Law. And Missouri Sunshine Law is an important tool through which citizens can keep their government officials accountable. And when you have law enforcement officials deciding that they are not bound by the law, bad things happen. And that's what prompted Show Me Cannabis to sue.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that when they brought in these multi-jurisdictional task forces, that it eliminated some of the checks on police power. Now, in what way or to what extent do these boards, if they were functioning, to what extent would they help restore some of those checks?
So if the board is functioning properly, it is putting controls on how the money the task force has is used. It would function as a disciplinary agent for any of the officers who get out of line, for any of the officers who commit abuse, things like that. But when you have an absence of a board, it means that the officers can, by and large, act with impunity. It means that there is no additional force holding them in check. They don't have an additional concern that if they get out of line, or if they misuse public funds, or if they deal with citizens improperly, that there's going to be someone there to put them in check. And so that's the real problem with the failure of an oversight board to function or to meet, is that they're not playing any of those statutorily required roles.
All right. Going to the task forces, you mentioned Kansas City and St. Louis. And before we get into the Sunshine aspect, if they haven't formed, or if they're not meeting, if these boards aren't meeting, Would there also be a legal remedy through filing some kind of a writ of mandamus?
Possibly. So writs of mandamus, and that's actually a very technical question. I'm happy to answer it. I don't think a lot of people understand what writs of mandamus are. They're called extraordinary writs. It means that courts employ them very, very seldom. But the idea of a writ of mandamus is if there is a clear legal obligation for a public official to act in a certain way, then a citizen can go to a court and say, hey, this legal official or this legal officer is not doing their duty. I need you to order them to do their job. And so if the court looks at what you bring in front of them and says, yes, this is a very clearly established responsibility, I'm going to issue a writ of mandamus forcing this official to do their job. What I have found, I've tried to pursue extraordinary writs on a couple of occasions in Missouri, and I found that courts are disturbingly unwilling to use a writ of mandamus, even when there's a pretty clearly established law. If there is any question whatsoever about the officer's obligation to take a certain action, the courts will just let it go. A particular example of this is the Missouri Constitution requires the governor to call special elections to fill vacant seats in the legislature, and there's a state law that says that he's required to do so without delay. Last year, there were 4 vacant seats in the Missouri General Assembly, and Governor Nixon continued to refuse to call special elections to fill those seats. So we sued, seeking a writ of mandamus to force him to call those special elections. And after we filed the lawsuit, he eventually did call special elections for 3 of those districts. He never called a special election for the 4th, and the courts refused to order him to do so because they argued, well, it's not really clear. Even though the Constitution says the governor is supposed to do this, and even though the statute says he's supposed to do it without delay, that's not clear enough for us to issue a writ of mandamus. So generally speaking, I try and avoid writs of mandamus now. I think the better approach, assuming you have time, is to file a declaratory judgment action, and that says, you know, look, there is this legal dispute, and we need the courts to settle it. Arguably, there may be some way that the officer could argue that they don't have to do whatever you say they have to do, but the way to resolve that is with a declaratory judgment action, not necessarily a writ of mandamus. And so that's what we've done here. We filed suits seeking declaratory judgment that the boards do have an obligation to comply with the Sunshine Law, that they do have an obligation to meet and to oversee these multi-jurisdictional task forces if those task forces are going to receive funding from the state. And then we've also asked for injunctions in St. Louis City and Kansas City against the Department of Public Safety, preventing them from awarding any additional state grants to these task forces until their boards are functioning properly.
All right. And I do, for the listeners who are just joining us, this is Craig Lubo, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice, and my guest again is David Rowland. He is the Director of Litigation, the attorney representing Show Me Cannabis, and they are doing a lawsuit relating to the Sunshine Law. What I want to do now is move to what the Sunshine Law is, David. First of all, I understand it applies to public meetings, so can you just define what public meeting is under the statute?
So it sounded like you were asking me to define public meetings. I'm sorry, our connection is not great. But so the Sunshine Law basically says that a public meeting is any meeting of a public governmental body at which the public business is discussed. It's defined very, very broadly. And so if there is it's also important to kind of identify what we mean when we're talking about a public governmental body. And the Sunshine Law, again, defines that really, really broadly. So essentially any legislative organization, any administrative organization, or any government group that has some public function is defined by the Missouri Sunshine Law as a public governmental body. And when it comes to the meetings, they're defined as any meeting of a public governmental body at which any public business is discussed, decided, or public policy formulated, whether such meeting is conducted in person or by means of communication equipment, including but not limited to a conference call, video conference, internet chat, message board, email. So to sum up, the Sunshine Law makes very generally the policy of Missouri that government is supposed to happen in the public view. And so when you take these broad definitions for public governmental body and broad definitions for public meeting and broad definitions for public records, it makes clear that the presumption is that Missouri citizens have a right to know what their government is doing in their name. And if there's any doubt about whether a meeting or a record is supposed to be open to the public, the assumption is to be that it is open to the public, and these public records and public meetings can only be closed if the government authority involved goes through certain statutory procedures that allow for the closure of those meetings and records, or in the alternative, if there are certain specific statutory exemptions that say this particular record is not considered to be an open public record. But with the Show Me Cannabis cases, really, there's no legitimate dispute about the fact that the records that they are looking for in St. Louis and Kansas City, they are public records. Where they've asked for the meeting minutes of the boards for these task forces in those cities. And there's no question that those would be considered public records. Now, it is theoretically possible that parts of those records might be closed. There may be some statutory exception that allows for parts of the records to be redacted, but what the government cannot do is simply refuse to produce records that are otherwise open to the public. Now, there are some different factors involved in the lawsuits that Show Me Cannabis is taking on. We have a lawsuit against the East Central Missouri Task Force that's headquartered in Audrain County, where I live. They actually turned away Aaron Mallon from a meeting that was supposed to be open to the public. They were having a executive board meeting for the task force, and Aaron went down to where the meeting was supposed to be held, and they had a lieutenant in the sheriff's office come and turn him away. Aaron actually announced he was with Show Me Cannabis, and he heard someone down the hall say, "He's with Show Me Cannabis, I'm sure he's recording," and under the Sunshine Law, citizens have a right to record a public meeting. When they came back, they said, "You're not allowed to attend this meeting. You have to leave." And so we sued the East Central Missouri Task Force for violating the open meetings provision of the Sunshine Law. And fortunately, their attorney has pretty well acknowledged that we are right. They violated the law. The real question in that case is not whether they violated the law, but rather whether they did so knowingly or purposely. And that's important because the Sunshine Law allows citizens to recover civil penalties against the government when they violate the law, as long as the official knew that they were breaking the law and in some circumstances that they knew what the penalties would be for breaking the law. We think that it's completely implausible for the chief law enforcement officers of about a dozen bodies over here in mid-Missouri to be unaware of the Sunshine Law and unaware of the fact that they are subject to it, especially because there were cases back in the late 80s where it was firmly established that even sheriff's offices are considered to be public governmental bodies under the Sunshine Law. They have to give up their records when they are properly asked to do so under the Sunshine Law. So with this having been established in Missouri for more than 25 years, we don't think there's any plausible plausible argument that they didn't know. Essentially, they've tried to claim ignorance. They said, well, we didn't know that we were subject to this law. Well, that's what the court's going to figure out. And we believe that when the court figures out that, in fact, they did know that they were subject to the Sunshine Law and they purposely chose to violate that law, we believe that they're going to be required to pay Show Me Cannabis a civil penalty and also that they're going to be required to pay attorney's fees.
And, Dave, if I understand right, then the Sunshine Law applies to both open meetings when it's required as well as disclosure of records. Is that correct?
Open meetings and what was the second part?
And that also applies to disclosure of records when you request
yes.
records. Okay. And for those you mentioned, Aaron Mallon, I just want to clarify, my understanding is he's the director of research for Show Me Cannabis.
That's correct. Aaron is Show Me Cannabis's director of research, and he has been the driving force behind a lot of the research that Show Me Cannabis has been trying to do in regard to how these drug task forces have been functioning in Missouri.
All right. And when you, as far as the lawsuits that are pending, is what is the progress of those lawsuits? Does it look like they're going to comply without you having to go to trial, or do you think you're going to end up having to go to trial?
Well, so we have four lawsuits currently active. We have another one that's going to be launched this week. The first lawsuit was against the Missouri Narcotic Officers Association, which, although it is not itself a branch of the government, it falls within the definition of what's called a quasi-public governmental body, and that is a unit that's made subject to the Sunshine Law under one of the provisions. But they have tried to avoid giving up their records. Essentially, what they do is it's a group of narcotic officers from across the state, and they engage in training. They basically have agreements with the Department of Public Safety to train narcotics officers to qualify for what's called post-licensure. It's police officer. Oh, I can't remember the exact word for what the S is, but it's essentially a form of certification that officers get that say that they're qualified to engage in narcotics investigation.
David, we are down to our last minute, so if you can
just
tell us who just briefly a few seconds as far as the other three, who the defendants are.
Okay, so the St. Louis City Task Force is one of the defendants. They actually tried to deny that their task force existed until Aaron found definitive proof that it did. The Kansas City Task Force, which is effectively trying to say that that they're not subject to the Sunshine Law, and the East Central Missouri Task Force is the third task force that we have sued, and we've got another lawsuit that's going to be coming down the pipes this week.
Okay. This has been Craig Lubo on Jaws of Justice, talking with David Nolan, who is the attorney for the Show Me Cannabis, talking about the Sunshine Laws. And thank you, David, for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, the calendar for May 18th, 2015. In March, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America released a new data visualization tool, The Weight We Carry. Weight is spelled W-A-I-T. To help more Americans understand that VA patients are individuals that deserve to receive the high-quality care they've earned through their military service. So far, 2,025 veterans from all wars shared their stories on the site. If you want to see the status of the veterans who have submitted so far, or want to submit your own story, go to the website, www.theweightwecarry.org. Recently, Bob McDonald, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, wrote a letter thanking the veterans who had responded and encouraging others to tell their stories as well. The VA hopes to use the information to improve service. If you would like for the VA to follow up with you, please email them at newmedia at va.gov with the subject line, "The Weight We Carry." Their customer service specialist will connect with you to get the information they need to reach out and address your issues. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Up next is a commentary from Behind the Bars by Kay Ray that was originally aired on Sunset Reggae, heard every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. here on KKFI 90.1 FM.
This is Kay Ray coming to you on KKFI 90.1 with the monthly report from Behind the Fences. This is a segment where we on the inside let you on the outside know what is going on within corrections and encourage everyone to get involved with the issues concerning family, friends, and loved ones in prison. The topic for this month is an NECC update. These are a few of the things which have been happening over the last month. Concerning the quote-unquote new security system being implemented here at NECC, we have seen two staff members get assaulted already, and they have only converted half of the housing units. They are continuing to change the electronic security for this place one housing unit at a time. In the end, the security only appears to be more effective, but in reality, the security is actually worse, with more choke points and slower response times to get to a more secure area in the prison. It is pretty simple math. The more electronically controlled gates you have, the slower the response times in an emergency situation. Sometimes, more is not always better. We're all wondering where 1,000 prisoners will go when this is all over, because they're going to turn half the prison into a high-level camp. Or is this just another ploy to generate money by having more high-level bed space, all while housing medium and low-level prisoners in those high-level bunks? Either way, it's a lot of wasted money. Concerning medical here, the new Corizon Medical is obviously designed for slow-moving long-term problems, as evidenced by a couple of key incidents we've had this month. One, a man who tried repeatedly for several days to get help in medical finally died. He had a stroke, and he'd been having many strokes daily for a few days, but medical continued.
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
But medical continued to send him back to his housing unit with no help. On the other hand, another man's heart went into AFib, or what they consider a very irregular rhythm, which can lead to stroke or blood clots. Well, he was sent out to the hospital, and medical continues to work to cure him. He still lives in AFib due to a thyroid malfunction, but overall, the bottom line is, if you can live long enough to get through the red tape of preliminary medical checks, then your chances of living go way up. Otherwise, you're in trouble. The maintenance department has had a pretty rough month. They finally got the giant security lights fixed on B-side. This light has been conveniently broke for over 8 months, which shut down the ball field and track areas of B-side, effectively reducing their yard size by less than half. However, no sooner than the lights got fixed, a 12-inch water main coming into the prison broke. So we have had a strange couple of days with water being trucked in for drinking. The water is now back on, and the hot water seems to be slowly recovering. Overall, there seems to be more changes forthcoming. And if they prove to be as effective as the most recent security upgrades, then things will be yet more dangerous, business as usual, and ultimately more expensive. Another clear case of you should not fix it if it ain't broke. And last but not least, the work release program here is still paying the workers as if they were on a state pay in-house job with $30 a month as top pay, just like the jobs in the kitchen, maintenance, and other areas of the inside prison. These are the same guys that are approved to leave the prison to work, have real low-level security, or a year less left to serve, yet they're not making the $7.50 a day that the rest of their work release prisoners are making in the state. Not to mention the very questionable spending of inmate canteen funds for what is not allowed by law. They pretty much have a blank check and they spend it on whatever they want. Overall, I can only see the conditions for staff and prisoners deteriorating till someone finally intervenes as management is run amok. I thank you for listening and encourage you to write into KKFI at P.O. Box 32250, Kansas City, Missouri 64171 with questions or concerns regarding the issues on this program. Also, you may email Sister G, sunsetreggae@gmail.com. This has been Kay Ray from Behind the Fences. Take care, God bless, thank you, and good night.
Good morning, and welcome to Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Kirsten Tynan. Her topic will be concerning fully informed juries in our court system. Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like for you to briefly introduce yourself, and then we could go into the areas that jurors need to know about if they don't already have some idea.
Sure. I'm Kirsten Tynan, National Coordinator for the Fully Informed Jury Association. We're a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to informing everyone about jurors' power to protect human rights by refusing to enforce corrupt laws and refusing to enforce inappropriately applied laws.
Okay. Kirsten, could you give us a little background as far as when you were incorporated and where?
We were incorporated, I think, in 1992 as a nonprofit in a tiny little town called Helmville, Montana. We're now headquartered in Helena. So,
yeah, right.
big jump for us.
Okay. You're a nonpartisan public policy research and education organization. So what is your main focus?
Mm-hmm. So we mainly focus on informing everyone of what they will not be told when they enter a courthouse.
Right.
And what they will very likely be misinformed about by a judge during when jury instructions are issued.
Okay.
The judge usually informs the jury that he will interpret the law. They have to accept it as he gives it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are only to rule on the facts of the case.
Okay.
That is not at all what the purpose of a jury is. Juries originated not only to judge the facts of the case, but also to judge the justice or lack thereof of the law as it's applied in the case at hand. And jurors still today have this right to judge the law, even if they're instructed otherwise. So we advise people to be sure to consult their consciences when they're deliberating in a case in order to reach a just verdict and not simply rubber stamp the conclusion to which they're led by a government judge and a government prosecutor who obviously have an agenda to push prosecution.
The jury is the final say-so on what the verdict is, so they really shouldn't be that concerned about what the judge has instructed them, to them. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. The jury cannot be punished for its verdict.
Right.
And once a not guilty verdict is delivered, the defendant cannot be tried again. So even if a jury believes a defendant has broken an unjust law, if the jury rules not guilty, that's it. It's over for the defendant. And I would also add that if a single juror hangs the jury, that's even still a much better verdict for the defendant than a guilty, because with a hung jury, the prosecution is going to have to decide if it's worth the time and expense of retrying the defendant for something that may technically be a legal violation, but which has harmed nobody. If there is no victim in the case, this is a great litmus test for jurors to consider. If there's no victim in the case, there isn't a crime. Nobody's been harmed. Why are we harming this person? We should vote not guilty.
Okay. Now, based on the Constitution, Article 3, it says that we're guaranteed our right to a trial by jury in a criminal case. Is that also correct for a civil case?
What the Constitution says and what is currently in practice are unfortunately slightly different things. It has been, quote-unquote, interpreted that even in criminal cases, people are not being afforded trial by jury unless they are at risk for 6 months or more in jail. So if you're at risk for only 5 months in jail, that could be decided unilaterally by a judge, which is clearly not at all what the Constitution intended. So unfortunately, in criminal cases and even sometimes in civil cases, what the Constitution requires is not actually being implemented in practice. And I think that kind of points to the power of the jury to protect people, that our government is so afraid of you know, putting people in front of a jury that they're denying them those kinds of trials in many, many cases. And in many other cases, trying to circumvent the jury system through plea bargains, which give the defendant a clear outcome, but one that may not be most beneficial to the defendant or even fair. And we see that a lot of times, for example, in drug cases where the defendant doesn't want to take a jury trial because, A, that's very expensive and the state has virtually unlimited resources at its disposal, whereas many defendants either don't have the resources or through asset forfeiture will have lost the resources before they've even been convicted to be able to fight, you know, on their own behalf effectively. So it's very the plea bargain system not only circumvents the jury system, but it's much more beneficial to the prosecution side and takes the risk out of it for the prosecution that, you know, decent people will look at the case and think it's ridiculous that we're harming someone who hasn't harmed anybody.
Okay, and as people support your organization, you have a lot of resources that they can use, like the Juror's Handbook Guide, and what other information can you offer to a potential juror?
So we have a number of brochures in our online library. Our most recent one is called Fresh Air for Justice, and it covers the basics of jury nullification and how one can go about protecting someone else's human rights. And, in fact, when we do that, we also protect our own in the process by simply not voting not guilty. It's as simple as that. When you are in deliberations, definitely deliberate along with everyone else who is on the jury. But we do recommend that you don't bring up the idea of jury nullification, because while it is a perfectly legal thing to do, it also is something that allows the judge to remove someone from the jury if it comes to light that they are considering that in a lot of locations. So we suggest that it either, you know, don't give a reason for your not guilty vote. You're not required to, but do stick to it. And if you do feel that you have to say something, simply say that you feel in your heart of hearts that it would be wrong to convict this person. That's a perfectly legitimate way to go about it. Do stick to your vote. I know there can be a lot of pressure in jury deliberations from other jurors, but remember that you don't have to come to a unanimous verdict either way. A hung jury is okay, and that is going to be much better for a defendant than if that one lone holdout juror caves to peer pressure and goes along with everyone else.
Okay, how important is it to pay attention to the jury foreman? What kind of pressure can they put on a jury?
The jury foreman, and in fact every other juror in the room, there can be a lot of peer pressure. I actually read about one case in which I think a 67-year-old woman was being stared down by like a former Navy SEAL, and he was like getting up in her face and everything. Didn't do anything violent, didn't threaten her, but clearly was putting a lot of psychological pressure for her to change her vote. And I was very thrilled to see that she didn't. That made me very happy because, you know, I mean, it can be very intimidating to have someone physically in your space, you know, looking cranky at you, you know, crossing their arms with that body language. And so it is very, you know, a lot of people I know who I would be surprised that they would consider changing their vote, you know, said that really they almost did, or in fact some of them actually did do that. We get calls in the office frequently from people who said, I felt pressured, so I changed my vote, and now I regret it because I think not guilty was the right vote. What can I do? But once you leave, once the verdict is delivered, there's very little that a juror can do. So we do encourage people to have a strong backbone. And if you do feel like someone is bullying you in some way, you can, of course, tell that to the judge and ask that behavior be stopped. But definitely, you know, stick to your own conscience. Don't rely on someone else's.
Okay, and I understand that if you don't have all the information you need, you can contact the bailiff and have her or him to give notes back to the judge to ask questions. So that's another way to safeguard what's going on with how you're going to vote. Another thing I see here is Voir Dire. Did I pronounce that correctly?
I think it's Voir Dire.
Voir Dire. Okay. Would you explain a little bit about that?
That is a French term that means to speak the truth, and it's currently the term for the legal process during which the jury is selected.
Right.
And prosecutors and defendants get to ask questions of the jurors and also the judge, and they kind of originally the idea behind it was to produce a non-biased jury. Unfortunately, the process has been perverted by both sides who have, you know, a vested interest in a certain kind of outcome. So they're trying to weed out jurors who are not favorable to their side. The best way for someone to get on a jury, which is something you have to do if you're going to be able to vote not guilty, the best way to do that is to give truthful but neutral answers that don't, you know, betray any sort of political bias. You don't want to sound too knowledgeable about any topic. You don't want to look like you're an individualist and stand out, so don't dress in a way that looks in any way unique. Try to wear just regular business casual type clothes or, you know, conservative jewelry, neat hair. Don't give any additional information that is not part of the question asked. A lot of times lawyers are taught to ask questions that will lead potential jurors to just run off at the mouth, basically, and that is how they get a lot of information that they didn't know to ask for.
Right.
So simply stick to very simple, short answers, answering only what the question asks.
All right. Would you give some information on how supporters can reach you, the different ways they can do that?
Anyone who is interested in more information or would like to volunteer and get an outreach campaign going in their community can visit us on the web at FIJA for Fully Informed Jury Association.org. And we also invite everyone to get a free jury power information kit by calling us at 1-800-TEL-JURY, 1-800-TEL-JURY. And you just leave your name and address, or a name and address, I should say. If you don't want to be identified, you can leave a fake name. We'll still send it out. And we'll send you a packet in the mail that contains a sample of all of our brochures and some more information about us.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to tell us that we don't know?
I would just add that everyone should be aware that they are not required to check their conscience at the courthouse door, and that your job as a juror is to protect other people's human rights by refusing to be complicit in rubber stamping a conclusion to which you're led by the judge and the prosecution. You are to be an independent judge of the facts and the law as you deliberate, and we hope that everyone will take that responsibility seriously to protect their own community and to protect themselves in the process.
Okay, and again, I hope potential jurors understand that you are the final check and balance on our American court system with the jury. If you have any questions about whether or not you're voting correctly, just like Kirsten says, vote with your conscience, your common sense and life experiences that may relate to that jury verdict. If you want to elaborate more, Kirsten, on some of your experiences, if there's anything that you know about going on with current cases, high-profile cases, or anything on that order.
Sure. There was actually a recent case that has some very important lessons for jurors that I'll just talk a little bit about. This was a case of Vernon Hershberger that took place in Wisconsin and was just decided, I think, last week. And he's a raw milk distributor who basically ran a private club that gave people raw milk who wanted that product. And he was charged with several licensing violations and also with violating a hold order on some goods at his property that hold order was based on the fact, or based on the claim, I should say, not fact, based on the claim that he had committed these licensing violations. So without the licensing violations, the hold order was not valid. So he went to trial on these, and the jury found him not guilty of the three licensing violations, and then very confusingly found him guilty of violating the hold order that wasn't valid if the licensing violations weren't valid.
Okay.
And so it was not clear how this could come about. Well, after the trial, once the jurors found out the information that had been withheld from them, they realized that a mistake had been made. The hold order had several key pieces of information redacted, so the jury never saw it while they were deliberating. And that's something that all jurors should be aware of. The information that they are getting is filtered through the judge. And the judge, of course, is getting paid by the same state that is paying the prosecutor.
Okay.
So there is a bias there, and they should be aware that they may not be getting all the information they needed. And if they feel that they don't have all the information, they should vote not guilty. And so, interestingly, after that, the jurors, actually, several of them wrote letters to the judge in defense of the defendant before the sentencing period, and several of them showed up at his sentencing for support. And the judge was quite taken aback by this, because that was very unprecedented. And in fact, several jurors are now speaking out in the media. I believe tomorrow evening they'll be talking to the community in Wisconsin at the public library in their area. And several of them have even expressed interest in possibly joining the Raw Milk Club and learning more about it. So it's one of those things where it's a very hard job for jurors to do when they are being given incomplete information, being given misinformation, but it's very important for jurors to kind of be smart about that and understand the tricks of the trade, so that they know, you know, when they get a bad feeling that, you know what, I don't think I'm getting the full story here,
mm-hmm.
or I don't think, you know, something's not right here. You can vote not guilty. And, of course, in any case where it's a totally victimless crime, you know, we know that those kind of violations are used to get more people into the prison system, especially now that we have private prisons making a profit from basically labor for, you know, slave labor. I mean, they're paid pennies on the dollar, if that. And we know that those kind of violations are often used against communities of color. They're disproportionately enforced. And obviously, it's a way for a system to perpetrate injustice, you know, through these victimless violations. So if there is a victimless violation on the table, I mean, it should be a very simple matter to say, you know what, no one was harmed by this person. My conscience tells me that I'm not supposed to harm this person by, you know, in any way penalizing them or putting them in prison.
Okay, how important is it to sequester different juries?
That can vary based on the case, but a lot of times sequestration is a way to cut jurors off from information that the judge does not want them to hear.
Okay.
A lot of times jurors cannot be punished for their verdict. However, jurors can be punished or removed for doing outside research on a
right.
case. And so oftentimes that is a way for a judge to keep jurors from finding out what penalty is at stake, or, you know, relevant information that the jurors might find important but that the judge does not want them to hear.
Right.
And that is also something that jurors should be aware of. They're not going to be told what penalty is at stake when they are deliberating. The judge is going to tell them that, unless it's in a capital case with a death penalty situation.
All right. Kirsten, thank you so much for interviewing with us by telephone today from Helena, Montana. We appreciate all the helpful information that you've given us. So this will give potential jurors something to think about in case they're called to serve. Thank you so much, and thank our listeners for tuning in this morning.
Thank you for having us.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Willie Nelson has a new book out now. It's a long story, and the following is from when I went on the bus to invite him to join law enforcement against prohibition.
What would you like to say to my audience out there, those that are having to fight for the right for marijuana?
Well, first of all, thank you for fighting, and thank you for standing up for your rights. And, you know, I was telling some folks today, you know, Kinky Friedman now has a cigar out with one of them with my name on it somewhere, and that somebody was asking me, you know, what I thought about all that. And I was, you know, I don't have any problems with it at all, you know. I figure, you know, I remember my friend Billy Cooper, you know, somebody said something to him about his drinking and he's smoking and all that, and he said, it's my mouth, I'll haul coal in it if I want to.
And that's the point. They talk about the danger of marijuana, and yet alcohol and tobacco are killing hundreds of thousands, and I don't think they've found the first marijuana casualty yet.
No, they haven't, and once they realize, though, how much money they're missing, once they realize how many millions and billions of dollars that the legal drug dealers are making, then they can step in there, and it'll help the farmers, it'll help everybody. And once they see, once they start saying, wait a minute, we should tax it and regulate it like we do tobacco and alcohol.
Your thoughts, sir. How, don't we all need to do more to bring this truth forward, to speak up that truth?
Absolutely. Whatever you're talking about, whether it's this, you know, or whatever, if you have something, an issue that you want to, you know, you'd like to see change, you got to get out there and do something about it. You just can't sit still and not talk about it. And, you know, you're the one that can start it.
Yeah. Willie, you know, over the years, I've admired your music. I think I remember perhaps a High Time Rolling Stones article talking about when you, in your younger days, your house burned down, and one of the things you salvaged from the house was a bag of, if I remember, Panama Red.
Well, yeah, I knew there were going to be difficult times ahead. So I salvaged what I thought. Plus, it was in my guitar case with my guitar, so I didn't want to lose that either.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question then.
Yes, sir.
Why should we legalize drugs?
Well, basically because we're funding the cartels, the terrorists. It's the reason most of these violent street gangs exist, sir.
What you guys are doing takes more balls and guts and nerves than what I'm doing. I'm just a guitar player. You guys are policemen, and you ride a lot of heat for what you do and say, a lot more than I do. So I applaud you for doing it, and God bless all of you.
Law enforcement against prohibition. These men and women have served in the trenches of the drug war as prosecutors, judges, cops, guards, and wardens. They have seen firsthand the utter futility of our policy and now work together to end drug prohibition. Please visit leap.cc.
Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Beth Pike for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday. Tell somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Go keep that smile on my face. Go teach my